for the gurus out there who are listening. But in the meantime, we wanted to focus this week on kind of the young, more inexperienced investors who are just starting out. And, you know, these are either college students or they're just out of college and they just started a new job and they've got some spending money or some money saved that they don't really know what to do with. And I know Todd gets this question a lot from his students, and I've even gotten this question before from some friends. Where do I start? And, you know, is it okay? I have, you know, $25 extra every month. Is that enough to start with? And I think the short answer is yes, but go ahead and give us the long answer.
Yeah, it's absolutely yes. You know, I think that, you know, you run the risk of analysis paralysis if you think about it too much. You know, I mean, there's a lot of platforms you can open your account on, E-Trade, Schwab, Vanguard. Most of them are pretty equivalent in what they'll do now and give you. So, I mean, just pick one. Pick one. Just do it. And just steal from Nike. Just do it. Get started. I mean, Joe, one of the biggest, most important decisions I made as a young man was to take just a little extra money that I was getting every month from working while I was in college and putting that into an aggressive growth fund. This was back in the early 1990s. And it was a really small amount. It was like $50 a month. I had extra just from working my part-time job while I was also taking my classes. And I put it into this aggressive growth fund. And I just did it consistently. Every month I contributed that $50. And then when I graduated from college, I, you know, got my first real job, I increased it a little bit. And then when I got a raise the next year, I increased it a little bit. So again, consistently allowing that money to build up in this aggressive growth fund. And then fast forward into my late 20s, Joe, that became my down payment on my house. So these little amounts may seem like, $25, that's just beer and pizza money. Well, over time, that can turn into a much, much more significant amount of money. You can buy a lot of beer and pizza thanks to compounding over time.
A lot of fridges to put your beer and pizza in.
That's right. I mean, I always look at, you know, people say, well, what's compound? What's compound interest? Why is that so important? And, you know, it's dealing to earn interest on your interest. So, Joe, if you invest $100 and you earn 10%, you now have $110. If you earn 10% on $110, that's an extra $11. You now have $121. If you earn 10% on $121, you get the point. You get the gist. So, for me, I think the biggest takeaway for invest people who are on the side, I don't have a lot of money, just do it. Just do it and be consistent. You know, don't. I'd much rather see someone be consistent and monthly, adding the money literally every month, than say taking a lump sum of $1,000, putting it into Robinhood and making some stupid decisions and then end up wiping out. It consistently into great companies or into a mutual fund or exchange trade funds are great, something like that.
Yeah. And the other thing that's important is, you know, a lot of these big firms, you know, they might seem intimidating, but to open an account, whether it's a brokerage account or an IRA, it takes minutes. And that's not an exaggeration. Like when I opened my IRA, it took a matter of minutes. It takes a little bit longer than that for it to get approved, but the process takes 10 minutes.
Right. And you brought up a great point too. I mean, I had done back in the 90s, I had just done a regular account, a regular investment account, taxable investment account. But you could do IRAs. If you have a job and you're earning income, you can open an IRA. Now, that raises a whole other question, right, Joe? Traditional versus Roth IRA or whatever.
Absolutely.
What did you choose? Did you choose a traditional or a Roth IRA?
I have a Roth. And I didn't do a ton of research on it when I opened it up. But for me, it just seemed like at the time that tax-wise, I would rather have to pay the tax now rather than pay the tax when I'm, you know, 62, 65, 70, whatever.
Right. And that's the difference between the traditional and the Roth IRA is that with the traditional, you get the tax deduction up front, but you're going to have to pay income taxes on the money when you take it out in retirement. And then the reverse is true with the Roth IRA. You don't get that tax deduction up front, but you do get to withdraw the money, the earnings in retirement. Tax-free. And I think one of the things that's important to remember with the Roth is it does give you some flexibility because since you are contributing with after-tax dollars, you can take your contributions out, get to meet just some basic guidelines, but you can take your contributions back out.
That's
without,
right.
Without having to do that.
But for certain events, if I'm not mistaken, like down payment on a house, and I think like a wedding, and there are a few other circumstances, not that you necessarily want to, but it's just nice to know that if you needed a little bit more for a down payment on a house or something like that, that you could tap into that if you theoretically needed to.
Right. That's one reason that I did that with my son, who's a teenager. You know, he has a part-time job now and he's making a little extra money. I didn't want to fight him with money. So we came up with an idea. Start a Roth IRA. You can contribute a little bit of money to your Roth IRA, pick some stocks, you know what I mean, in your portfolio. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking to myself, you know, if he needs to, he can tap this money for his down payment on his first home or whatever, or he can just let it build over time and have other savings. Now, in my personal life, I've always used more of the traditional IRAs because I wanted to have the tax deduction. So each person is going to be a little bit different for their particular situation. And there are some rules, you know, associated with the IRAs. You can only earn up a certain amount of income every year. Those change every year. Best way to find out and stay on top of it is just to Google IRS IRA contribution limits, and it'll bring you right to the website at the IRS. You'll be able to look at, see all the limits and restrictions. But for most people, especially if you're young and you're just starting out, you're not going to have to worry about those income restrictions. It's not really, really just for people who are now maybe hitting their stride in income, but for younger people just getting started out. The other thing too, Joe, a lot of people don't know this, there is something called a saver's credit. So you could qualify for a saver's credit. So if you fill out your own tax form, you want to be aware of it. The saver's credit can give you up to a 50% tax credit. Now remember, not a tax deduction, which lowers your taxable income, but a tax credit would actually lower the amount of taxes you have to send to the government. So if you have income below their certain limits, you could get the saver's credit as well. So that's an extra added incentive to someone maybe who's young and just starting out to go out and actually, as I said before, just do it. Open the account, put some money aside.
Absolutely. So moving on then. So, you know, you've made it to this first stage, you have an account, whatever it is, brokerage account, IRA, you might have $25 in it, you might have $2,500, you might have $25,000. Regardless, what's the approach for somebody in the 18 to 25 age range? It's all about growth, right?
I think so. I mean, you have growth investing and you have value investing, right? And, you know, if you look at value investing, you're probably thinking, you know, Warren Buffett, right?
Exactly.
This whole idea of I'm going to buy stocks really, really cheap, and then I'm just going to let them appreciate over time forever. And that can work. It can work. But if you look at the data over time, for most investors, it's been better to focus on growth stocks. And when I say growth stocks, I mean companies that are seeing year-over-year revenue growth of, let's say, 20% or higher, and they're seeing improving in the earnings. They're also, say, 20-25%. If you're looking at William O'Neill's research, he said that the biggest winners were usually growing at a pace of 25% over time. So, I mean, you can either buy the S&P 500, you know, index ETF, which is going to have some value stocks, some growth stocks, whatever. Or if you're picking and focusing on individual stocks, I would focus on growth or aggressive growth since you're so young. You have so much time to make up for any potential hiccups along the way. I would do that instead of value.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And when in doubt, you know, if you're overwhelmed by the just massive amount of different stocks out there, or you just simply don't have time to put in your research, you know, there are so many ETFs and mutual funds that are fantastic. If you just, you know, when you're in your brokerage account, if you just search, you know, growth or high growth or long-term growth, you'll find just a laundry list of different potential funds, some of which, you know, you need to do a little bit of background research and just see, you know, how they're rated, where the assets are allocated. But for the most part, those are a safe bet as well.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is too, Joe, you can think about it strategically and say, well, I do want to have a little bit, I want to have, say, most of my money, say 80% in an S&P 500 exchange traded fund. You know, let's let let's just put that 80% in there and let the market do what the market's going to do. And then maybe take the other 20% and be focused on maybe these more aggressive parts of the market or individual stocks that you think offer upside opportunity. What I wouldn't do is I wouldn't just go and run around and chase whatever you happen to see on Robinhood or FinTwit as being hot stock. One of the things in my class that I teach how to talk stock, we start off very, very top level and say, what are the products you love? What are the businesses that you love? And then come up with, some sort of a thesis for why you think that that's a stock worth owning. So for example, if you love Dunkin' Donuts coffee, you might say to yourself, I love Dunkin' Donuts coffee. Everybody's going to continue to drink coffee. I think this one could be a very good investment. You start there. And then from that, you can start looking at these individual things and say, okay, is this good investment? So what you want to do is you'd want to say, okay, well, what's the size of the coffee market? And is it growing or is it shrinking? What is Dunkin' Donuts' share of that coffee market? And then you want to say, okay, well, what are some of the risks? Well, they have competition from Starbucks and others that you have to keep in mind. Okay, they have to keep innovating. Can they navigate those risks? Yeah, I think they can navigate those risks, right? So then you would say to yourself, okay, well, let's look at a couple financial metrics and see whether or not the financial metrics look good. And for me, if I was pushed into a corner and said, you only have a couple seconds to analyze a stock and you only pick three financial data points to consider, for me, it would be year over year growth. It's always the rate of change. So year over year growth in revenue, operating margin, the trend in operating margin, and the year over year growth in earnings. So those would be the three. And then from that, you should then be able to come to the conclusion of whether or not you want to own the stock. That's a very loose framework, but at least it gives you a starting point to be able to say, okay, if I want to start investing in individual stocks, I don't want to just, click a button because I saw it in Robinhood or somebody was talking about it in a store and I overheard them. That's kind of the thinking that you should approach these stocks with.
Exactly. That might not be like the most thorough research, but at least that way you'll be able to weed out a lot of stocks that you probably don't want to invest in. And again, there's always thing, ETFs. Joe,
yeah. And then the other thing, Joe, too, is, you have to decide what's right with your sleep at night factor. If you're young and you're single and you don't have any kids, you can probably have all of your money just in stocks and then maybe some emergency savings to pay, your rent if something happens, rather than, say, buying something very safe, safer, like bonds or having a money market account or something like that. Allocation, whether or not be in equities or be in bonds, that really doesn't come into play until to have a much larger account and you have some responsibilities at home. And usually the rule of thumb on that is simply just say, take 110. So let's assume that the longest that you're gonna live is 110, something like that. And then subtract your current age from that. And then that's the amount that you should have invested. So let's say that you think that you're gonna live to 100. Right? And let's say you're 30 now. Well, have 70% of your money in stock.
Yep. That's an excellent framework as well. So there's another kind of scenario for people who are on the kind of upper end of this 18 to 25 age bracket. So they're out of college, they're employed, and they're employed full time. And because of that, they have 401k plans available to them. So again, this can be somewhat of an overwhelming thing for people who don't have a lot of experience in investing. So if, especially for people who already have a brokerage account or an IRA of some sort, how do you suggest these kind of recent college grads approach the 401k?
Absolutely, get in on that 401k. They might be matching dollars that are associated. I am amazed, Joe. I am absolutely amazed at how high the percentage of people of it is. Workers that have access to a 401 or a 403b plan that don't take advantage of it. It seems 100% silly to me. Take advantage of it. And honestly, it may seem tough initially, but try to do 10 to 15% of your money into your 401 or 403b plan. Live a little lean in your early years when you're single, you're just starting out. Live a little bit leaner than you might want to, because again, compounding will pay off for you the more you put in up front when you're young. It's just so important. And I talk to people and they're like, yeah, I have my 401k plan. Well, what do you contribute? Oh, 3%, 5%. Cool. You're not gonna generate real, real wealth at 3 to 5%. All right. You know, think 10 to 15% if you really, really want to move the needle when it comes to accumulating a high net worth for retirement. So yes, as soon as you get that job, as soon as you get that form, fill it out. At a very minimum, though, go up to the matching number.
Yep.
Whatever they match. If they don't match, whatever, doesn't matter. Still participate in the 401k plan. Still do it. I would also recommend, and Joe, they're doing this a lot more now. They have something called auto escalation features. So what you do is you check mark a box, and every year it will automatically increase how much you contribute to your 401k. You set it and forget. And what's great about that is, like, let's say you get a 3% raise every year. You've also set your auto escalator to go up by, say, like 1% a year, right? You won't even notice it. You won't even notice it. And yet, thanks to compounding, another great way to be able to build up a huge account in year.
That's right. It makes a huge difference in the long run. And one thing that you mentioned in there that's really, really important to point out is matching, because it is literally free money. And if you're, you know, anybody should be taking full advantage of that. If it's, regardless, again, as you said, if it's 1%, 3%, 5%, doesn't matter. If you're not contributing that full percentage, you are leaving money on the table that is available to you at basically no cost.
You just nailed it. Absolutely. I mean, that would be silly. Would you walk away from a $20 bill that was just laying there on the table in front of you? No.
Right. Exactly. Never. Yeah. So you also pointed out living lean, which is a very, very important message for, you know, people who are out in the workforce, and maybe they get a promotion and they're really tempted to go on a big extravagant trip, or, you know, move into a really nice apartment, or go out and buy a brand new BMW. And that stuff's great, but that's not long-term kind of financial responsibility, I suppose. You know, it's great. Yeah, it's great. It's a great short-term indulgence, but how long are you going to have that new BMW before the maintenance comes back and bites you in the butt?
Right. And then you're just going to lease it, or you're going to turn it over every 3 years, and you're going to be upside down. So you're going to have that payment forever. Right. Does that make sense? No. I mean, we do one of the exercises that we do in the classes. We pull up the compound interest calculator. You can just Google on Google compound interest calculator plus government. And the government has great compound interest calculator. And we pull it up and we say, okay, well, what do you think your monthly payment would be? And then they, you know, we figure out, okay, the average monthly payment is usually about $400 or $500 a month. And then we say, okay, well, if you had taken that $400 or $500 a month, put that instead into the S&P 500, how much would that be worth if it earned 6% on average per year for the next 40 years, or 8%, or 10%? And what you find out is that the opportunity cost of owning that fancy BMW is a million dollar decision.
Yep. Yeah, it's a million-dollar mistake leasing or buying a $40,000 car. It's pretty remarkable. The other calculator that I've seen and used before is, if you, again, just Google like Roth IRA calculator or traditional IRA calculator, and there are all these different websites that have these tools. You can put in your current age, the age that you want to retire, and then your annual contribution. So obviously it'll cap you at the limit, which is like 6,000 and something for a Roth. And it'll show you this beautiful graph of, if you just contribute $5,000 a year, that will appreciate to $1 million by the time you're 50. If, you know, with the standard S&P 500 return of, you know, 6 to 10% annually.
Yeah, it's just, it's phenomenal that the how much, and I think that those calculators and those tools really drive it home. So even if you're a listener, maybe you're already investing, you do your 401k, you're following through on all these things, you know, share it with your kids. You know, show them at a relatively early age these calculators and let them play around with it. And, you know, I think that maybe that will instill some really good financial discipline within them as well.
Yeah, I think I got my IRA when I was like 19. And I have a buddy whose parents signed him up for one at like 15. And I'm a little bit jealous of him, you know? He's like, I sort of feel like he's 4 years ahead of me.
Right, and he is with 4 years of compounding, right? So I mean, it really does, it does make sense to try and do that, and like I did with my son when he got his first part-time job with that Roth IRA as well.
That's absolutely
something that parents might want to consider doing for their young investors in their life.
Yeah, so just wrapping things up on this segment, so there are a few morals of this story. First moral is just do it. As you said, so easy. Whether you have $25 or you have $2,500, just start. Put it into an index fund or an ETF and just let it ride. Contribute regularly. When you're out of school, live lean and let it grow, because it'll pay off in the end.